you've heard now from three very different businesses involved in freight activities, and what we'd like to do is just engage them in the discussion. So, anybody want to start?
Upper Mac, just for my own point of reference, you guys agree less with folks like Pacer and others. We're actually customers of theirs and they're customers of ours. We compete head on,
yes.
And but we also bring they do one thing very well. We do a group of things very well. So well, just like with the permits normally we will compete with them on a direct basis for a specific type of customer. Competition helps everybody make more money, right? Yeah. It saves money. But yes, the answer is yes, we compete with them and we also, we're a very big customer. For instance, that we competed with some of the big asset-based players in our business, the Hunts and the Hubs and the Snyders and the Swifts are the big four intermodal players in our marketing world for the retail environment. And so when we have a customer, we will bring Pacer equipment in as an option. Folks like that, yeah. But other times, it's relationship business. So they reach out to us for, we just need things for the customer. It really boils down to the relationship that they have with that customer. Some people, it's just flat numbers and they don't care who does what, but those people normally come back to seeking a strong relationship. People who know their business inside and out can bring added value and be very proactive versus just paying a mile difference for the same equipment.
But what percentage of the business is actually being a carrier versus being a 3PL, not an asset?
Well, the different divisions basically are broken. Our core market, our historical core market, has always been the intermodal piece using somebody else's equipment. But in the past 10 years, our highway brokerage model has surpassed our revenues on our intermodal side. So we are we're highly successful in our highway brokerage. We don't own any truck lines. We just work with them.
Yeah, good question.
Yeah.
Block those DSS interactions, obviously you've got a lot of interchange rates for my property. How does rate making occur? Does the Waco initiate rates and services, and how does DSS interact with that?
It varies depending on what the property is. It could be a set amount determined by the contract and the way that it's structured, or it could be something where Waco has the opportunity to network with that market manager on the DNSS side on a regular basis with ongoing business. So it varies on the property.
A lot of times when we set up a short line connection, we negotiate that portion of the business up in the contract where we may pay the short line and flat fee for every car we deliver to them regardless of where it comes from. In some cases, you know, maybe it's a $500 per car fee that like Kansas City Terminal Railroad, which Waco operates for the Class 1 carriers here in town. There is a flat fee for cars to be delivered to any of the KCT locations within the town. And then the railroad that delivers that car to the KCT absorbs that cost in their rate. So that's the way some of it's done. And then in the instance where maybe we engage Shoreline to take over a switching operation for us for an industrial park, we'll pay them a flat rate to take that business on. Where we interchange with, like Shelley said, with a short line that may be, that operates maybe 100 miles of railroad that may also connect to another Class 1 carrier, they may be part of the rate negotiation process, and we'll go to them and ask them for their revenue requirements for that move to that location, and we'll add that to our rate and then go back to the customer.
Well, the question is, a lot of us look to our federal partners to say, recognize the importance of rate, and in your case, you want to cut into the interstates on your 35-foot new interchange, and with the regulatory agencies, are they all recognizing the importance of rate, and how's that going for you?
The regulatory agency has been very helpful on the new garden project as far as the new interstate cuts that we're talking about for the new interchanges. It's key to make the project work. And they've been on board and the public partnership arena from the get-go and have been very instrumental and very helpful and on board. And that goes back to not only the Department of Transportation, but also legislative governors been on board with this too, because they do recognize the importance of the transportation mode and the creating jobs in the future. Yeah.
Keep
I'll just do the first part and I'll hand off to them. In my arena, I do economic development. My job is to locate new business, rail, reoccurring business on the railroad, whether it's through intermodal or through directly rail served buildings or properties or plants. And one of the biggest hurdles that we face in locating new industries on the railroad is the cost of establishing that. Now, if it's a new interchange for an intermodal customer, the DOT, yes, they need to be engaged. But also for new spurs or rail infrastructure that needs to be built, it needs to be a funding mechanism other than, you know, right now, most states, some states, I think Illinois has a loan program still in place. Iowa does, used to have a grant loan program in place for rail infrastructure. Can strike to cover to community development block grants. Missouri, Brian, help me out. I can't remember exactly. We do that. We can do it with community development block grants too. But it would really be beneficial if each state had a rail program that we could go right to and say, okay, the state's in for this, if the customer's in for this, and maybe the railroad has to have a piece of it. We really don't have a really set funding mechanism for the rail side of from the DOTs, but from the, it's a lot easier to do it from the roadside to get the road infrastructure built to the, you know, to their health because of the local and the regional involvement, you know, political involvement in the DOT. So that's my economic development stand. I'd like to see more state programs for rail infrastructure.
It's interesting. I think you, this organization is addressing some of the primary needs on the highway side. Some of the research projects that you guys are involved in actively now. I just was reading one on the research project for the rest stops where the truck drivers just don't have enough rest stops. And with the hour of service regulations being enforced in so many different ways now, the truck lines take seriously, as do those who employ the truck lines. The courts have made it perfectly clear that as a third-party logistics company, when we hire a truck line to pick up a load from this shipper to take to this company, that it's our responsibility as a 3PL to make sure that we give that truck driver time to make that load within the hours of service regulations. That didn't used to be the case. It was pick up here, can you get it here by midnight tomorrow night? And don't care how you do it, don't know how many loads, but you have to do it, but can you do it? That was kind of the old way. But now, you start seeing them go by the truck stops, you go by the rest stops, 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you start to see trucks piling there to get their spot. It is a very, very serious issue, and I'm glad to see that the Mississippi Freight Coalition, this Valley Freight Coalition, is addressing that. So that's one big area I think we're addressing. The other area is the fuel. With the cost of diesel, traditionally, historically, being lower than gasoline, and now it's because of the refinery issues or the political issues or it is higher because they can make it higher. Type issues. Fuel is a serious issue when it comes to highway. Rail business intermodally is down in part because I could move a truckload out of Kansas City to Los Angeles cheaper than I could put it on the BNSF. That's total cost. And I can move it from California and move to Los Angeles back to Kansas City cheaper than the charge on the rail. So and fuel is the driver of that. The line haul portion tends to wash out, but the fuel surcharge is what drives it. As the fuel goes up, then the rail becomes a better option. Service wise, the railroad is almost equal to truck within 24 hours. Excellent service on the rails now. There's just outstanding. But the differential is the fuel. So part of the decline of intermodal is the fact that the truck lines are going to have more and more rail freight. And as fuel flips, that will reverse itself. And so those are the two big issues. There doesn't seem to be a driver shortage right now in the industry because of the capacity issues, because of the freight recession, there's not as much. And we have large truck lines, some of the top 10 truck lines that we do business with, including the J.B. Hunt's and the Snyder's and the Swift's, who historically have avoided doing business with folks like us. They'd rather develop their own customer base rather than coming through a brokerage operation. But we've had those carriers knock on our doors and approach us and say, "What can you? We've got freight from Atlanta that we need to get back to New Jersey or freight from Central Iowa or Ohio back to this lane. Can you help us?" And we can. And we did. So that's been part of the success. So the two big challenges you guys, I think, are addressing and that you say as well as we do. The other thing I think that the truck lines would like to see is maybe some more education for the four-wheel drivers. The people who drive cars have no idea what it's like to be in a 53-foot van driving and going down the road and have a guy that's just irritated at you because you're throwing water spray or you're going 65 mile an hour because that's the speed line and he can go 75 and he didn't have any clue how long it takes you to slow down. He doesn't have any clue how hard it is to drive that truck. And I think that's a real marketing effort. The truck lines try to do it, the owner-operators, the associations, that sort of thing. But I don't know if there's any kind of this group of engineers or planners can do anything with. I don't know. That's a big challenge that we see.
As a short line, I say I agree with Steve's comment. What I'm finding are customers looking at existing rails that have not been utilized for quite some time, but getting the funding to get that line up to our four rail service. Also, we kind of approached that conversation within the peeling sessions that occurred in the state of Kansas, utilizing the network to its full potential if it's already there. So I think that the funding becomes a key comment that needs to be at the forefront.
I don't know if you heard really Gary's comments this morning, but one of the things that we as a coalition have talked about continuously since we started is the notion that we have to use all the modes to their best advantage, which means in large part a greater share of the body moving in an intermodal fashion. And Gary talked about a project that he's involved in, the coal line, where they're trying to actually foster an intermodal facility to intercept the entities with the NS. But what kinds of policies should public agencies be pursuing if we want to actually foster intermodal movements?
I get requests all the time, just like that. Everybody wants an intermodal facility in their community. And I tell them all the same thing. We have a questionnaire that we'll provide to them and ask them to answer that. And basically, you know, we have intermodal facilities on our system that probably shouldn't be operating, but we keep them operating because of the customer, primarily. Right now, if you can't put together a minimum of a train per week going from point A to point B, and I'm not talking about any other point, you shouldn't even be talking to us. And that's going to be potentially 200 loads a week. And then we'll talk to you. But that doesn't mean we're going to put the service in or we'll help you put the facility in. But that's kind of what I'm telling people is, you know, we'll talk to you about it for a private intermodal ramp. That's what it is, a private intermodal ramp to create service. And that means you've got to have a customer lined up that's going to take 200, or customers that are going to take 200 trailers a week. They're going to load them on a train. They're going to send them from your community to one point. We're not going to let that thing fan out and go to five or six different destinations, because those are in our efficiencies, and that's what it's all about. So that's kind of my rule of thumb when I'm talking to communities. And right now, in the steamship lines, you know, you have to. It's just not just the railroad. You've also got to find the equipment to load, or get the coalition, like you said, the base of customers to put this together.
Found out I was down in Rolla, Missouri, and calling my customer down there, and he said, "Are you familiar with this? I've got a survey." And I said, "No, what is it?" And one of the researchers was actually doing a survey of the customer down there. When I seen the survey, I thought, geez, I want to know more about this and how this is going to work, because we do a lot of intermodal into and out of the Columbia, the Kansas City, the Rolla, Mexico, Missouri, kind of the middle part of the state. But it has to come into Kansas City to ramp, and then we put it on a truck and haul it down to that place where they unload the container. And then we either try to find a load going back domestically or internationally, and then send that container back to the West Coast. One of the things that happens with the import containers, there's two different types of intermodal movements. One is the import containers, which are owned by steamship lines, people like Angel and Costco and folks like that. They own those 40-foot containers, and they bring them in full of product from mainland China, and they come to one of the ports on the West Coast traditionally, and then it goes off of that ship onto one of the rail boxes or one of the rail cars, and then it comes into one of the intermodal parks. That he was showing you either in Alliance, Texas, outside Dallas, or in Chicago, or in Kansas City, or Memphis, or wherever it's going to unload. But for this discussion, let's say it comes into Kansas City. So it comes into Kansas City at the beginning of a rail yard down in Armourdale, where we then dispatch a what we call a drayman in our rail side. We dispatch a little short cartage company to go get it. He goes and grabs that box for the chassis and hauls it down to Mexico, Missouri to this customer. And where that customer then gets the box, unloads it, and now it's empty down there. And so then we have to do something with it. And we only have a certain amount of time because the railroads and the container owners don't want to sit in that yard for 30 days waiting for them to unload it. So you have 2 days to get it unloaded or get it back to the rail yards. So it's kind of goes out telling your one of your researchers. If I have a customer in Mexico, Missouri, that wants to ship a trailer load of a trailer flat car load to New Jersey, for instance, and wants to use a CSX or wants to use ENS or whatever
rail line wants to go out that way. There is no TOSC service from St. Louis going east. I cannot load a trailer out of St. Louis anywhere eastbound or anywhere in the southeast. A trailer. I can load a container, but I cannot load a trailer. So the advantage over a trailer and a container is the weight of the equipment. I can load 47,000, 48,000 pounds of product on a trailer, but I have to maintain it because of the weight of the containers. I can only load 43, 44 max at the top end of that, so I can scale it when we're trying to make the delivery to our end. So there's restrictions all around. There is a need, I think, for an intermodal availability, but the intermodal process, what he's talking about, is these high-speed, long-haul destinations. So you come from Los Angeles to Chicago, and Los Angeles to Kansas City, Los Angeles to Dallas, and they're high-speed. They don't stop in route. They can't stop in Denver to pick up their offload truck. They can't stop in Albuquerque to offload truck. Otherwise, you lose your speed. People cannot take that sort of supply chain away. So they have a difficult time stopping in route, either pick up and unload other freight. But the rails have built this remarkable model where it's all long distance, high speed, excellent service lanes. You can get from Los Angeles to Atlanta now 6 or 7 days delivered. You never used to have that sort of rail service. And that's an MCA partnership. So they're not going to stop in Little Rock, Arkansas and pick up an intermodal. In fact, they close the intermodal lanes in Little Rock, Arkansas. They can't. Their models are built on speed and efficiency because they're competing with trucks. And so that's their model. So when he's talking about trying to add something in the middle part of Missouri that doesn't fit the model of the people you're trying to do business with, it's an uphill battle. That's why he asked that, and I told you the same thing that he said.
Yeah.
Basically the same thing. You got this much, then maybe we'll talk to you about it. That sort of stuff. So it's something that needs more dialogue.
But it's not that we don't want to operate like that. We can handle intermodal just the same way we handle our unit grain trains. You know, but it has to be from point A to point B, and it has, you know, it's going to be a dedicated train to go from one point to the other. And that's what a lot of the communities fall down on. They think, well, we can grab the 200 trailers, but, man, they want the 200 trailers, 200 containers, they just want to spread, and they want to go to 6 or 7 or 20 different destinations. And we say, that isn't going to work for us. That's not our model.
What about from a short line perspective? How do you
fit
into the equation that
they're talking about? Well, we could provide the on-site services and the trucking services. So really what we try to do is understand the Class 1 business model. And for shippers, I think it's important to, oftentimes we forget to really go out there and research what is that model. So bring new business to the rail, what are the, not restrictions, but let's discuss what's best for each partner. And I think that dialogue gets lost sometimes. I know even at a short line perspective, we may have a customer that just shows up anticipating business on day one, and we'll make it happen. But it's always best if we have a conversation about it, we can make certain that the track is up and ready for repair, and provide the extended services. Like a situation, whether or not that is the company outbound move, that perhaps DNS is not, they find that a disadvantage for them.
Other questions? Yes. I guess there was the relationship that maybe states and the federal government really don't understand great business models. Do you think as state or public policy that we should do more or better job of trying to understand why and push it down to our local constituencies?
I think it's important that it's ongoing conversation because the model stays the same, but oftentimes business is altering from any given year. So it just needs to, yes, be readdressed on a regular basis and given to the proper context, I believe.
And that goes back to earlier when we were talking about how the state became involved very quickly on the Gardner project. It didn't, it took a little bit of sell-job, but not much, because they understand the importance of an intermodal facility within their state. And yes, I think that the education part is very important. And I do that every time I'm out with the local constituency. When that question comes up, I'm trying to educate them on our model, why it would not work in their community. But they need to figure out the best way to move from their community to where the intermodal facility is. If they need to come up with an incentive to help offset rate charges or whatever, that's what they need to be thinking about versus trying to put an intermodal facility in their community.
I think you're seeing exactly what you're talking about more and more. It seems to me that there is more dialogue, more opportunities to network with the various pieces of the puzzle in transportation now than there ever has been before. It's always been isolated where the truck lines and we have our own little organizations that we're members of. You guys have yours and the rails have theirs and the shipper groups have theirs. And now we're starting to see some cross-border and we're starting to see some pulling together. And to declare upon our comment, it's not that in that middle part of Missouri using the short line railway, Columbia, wouldn't work. It may not work in the particular fashion that we're initially thinking it might. It might have to be something where something is short lined into a hub, like Columbus or a St. Louis or something like that, where then it's dispersed into the other railroads. If you go into St. Louis hub and then go to BNS or go to the CSX or go on the UP or something like that. You know what I mean? It's not that it won't work exactly. It's just that it needs more, maybe there's a creative out of the box model like what Watco brings to some of your customers using the Columbia Rail or something like that. Is all that. I think there's a lot more of these sorts of opportunities now, these sorts of dialogues than I've ever seen before.
The other thing that I'd like to add, I think the Class 1 and the short lines are working very closely together to try to find an out-of-the-box solutions for different opportunities that arise, too. So you just don't, you know, oftentimes we get out there and we have a thought and we address it with one person and we think it's going south. Keep that conversation open once you've addressed it with all the right contacts, whether it be the Class 1, the state, and the short line, and make certain that they've all had some opportunities to kind of review what avenue should we go. And, you know, somebody may come up with a creative solution there.
Just one final question, and it's revealed in this last conversation. All of these states and most of the NPOs represented here are trying hard to get more private sector involvement in their transportation planning programming decision-making processes. And I think they are finding a fair amount of reticence on the part of the private sector to actually take part. What would your suggestion be as to how to get more folks like you to sit in a room like this, I guess is the real question.
Well, Mark, the Medical Regional Council, I think has done a fine job on keeping the metropolitan area citizens educated on what we're looking at, transportation, you know, 2030, 2050, and inviting them to those open forums until that citizen is educated on what the topic is and that they actually can provide some insight into it. I don't think they are going to get too involved. So really the education piece is key.
Okay. I know Deb Miller has started in the last 7 or 8 months a dialogue and invited all modes of transportation to participate with their regional conference or sit down work type workshop environments, and then she's putting out a bi-monthly newsletter on where we're at and the things that are going on with DOT, and I also get that from Missouri. I get updates from the Missouri Department transportation on what's going on in our area, and but you know we really haven't engaged directly with that. Unfortunately for me, I'm going 100 miles an hour all the time, it seems like, anymore, because I have a large territory to cover. Don't have time to stop and really engage with some of the ideas and the policy making of the DOTs and the use of the rail industry. But when it comes to the intermodal side of it, yeah, we are being, I think we're pretty engaged and I think we're all key by talking more about our presentation about it.
There are, I mentioned several organizations that are around. One that you can find on the internet to engage the shipping public for primarily truck transportation is called the Council of Supply Chain Management Professionals, and it's CSCMP.org. And they have 172 organizations called roundtables around the world. And so we've got three of them here in Missouri. We've got the Heartland chapter of the CSCMP. Now, these are the top shippers involved in this organization. These are the Hallmarks, the Sprints, the Embarks in our area. These are some of the top shippers that are involved in this professional organization. And there's chairman and program directors, and there's opportunities to speak, there's opportunities to reach out and grab representatives from all of the modes who are participants in these organizations, people like ourselves that's both an asset and an asset-based company. So the CSCMP.org, if you look at the website, and you say find a roundtable, if you're in Milwaukee, you can find a roundtable of shipping professionals there to invite into some of your meetings. That's the premier one. There's also in the warehousing, there's the WERC, the warehousing people. It has all the third-party warehouses and the rigging. All these folks are more than happy to come and participate and speak out or give you some insights. It's just that they don't know you exist. Because when you're talking about the municipalities and the states, the lower the profile we have, the better we are. So it's just kind of, that's just kind of nature of the beast. It's not that you're the enemy. We just keep a low profile. And like Stephen, everybody's wearing multiple hats now. And so we're all extremely busy. When I approached my boss about coming to speak to this, he goes, what value will that bring? And I said, I don't have a clue. I've never been one. I don't know who these people are. Not sure what they do, but I want to go find out. And so that's part of it. I contacted the Missouri Department of Transportation chiefs whenever I have questions about the legalities of moves, or I've got hours of service questions, or I've got truck questions. We have our Missouri or Kansas DOT folks all the time. I prefer Missouri. This is kind of a plug for one of your legal guys, David Woodside. Has been extreme help to me for many years. Never met him, but he's got to be about 90 with a cane now. But on Missouri, remember, I had a legal question that requires a court interpretation. I always turn to David, and he's always helpful to do that. So I think the organizations that are there, we just got to find out about each other and learn them. What you guys are doing, what we're doing, reach out to one another. I think they'll find that we're not resident at all in those environments.
Great. Well, I want to thank you, Stella. I think it's been a wonderful experience. Thank you.